The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, the conscience of psychiatry. And as always, before getting to my guest, a particularly marvelous guest, I want to tell you about what we've been up to lately. Some of you have been following on this show or on my website, Bragan.com, or on Huffington Post blog that I do, the fate of the 16-year-old boy in Canada who, after getting worse and worse on Prozac, against the protests of the parents, the psychiatrist raised the dose of Prozac of the 16-year-old, and 17 days later, in an agitated state, he knifed to death with one blow a very close friend with virtually no provocation. The judge in a hearing declared that Prozac was the cause of this young man's actions. This is the first time that a judge in North America has himself or herself come out and said this. We've had cases where judges have approved a plea of, say, involuntary intoxication with Prozac. We've had cases where judges have approved suing drug companies for violence and suicide caused by the antidepressants. But this is the first time a judge, when put right on the spot himself, has concluded that Prozac caused a violent death. And now the judge has had his sentencing hearing and repeating his belief that Prozac was the source of the boy's violence. He has ordered the boy to be released in 10 months. He could have stayed in jail for a couple of more years as a youth, and he could have spent much of his lifetime in jail if the judge had not decided to try him, to judge him as a youth. So this is a good ending. The young man's going to have 10 months now to get used to the idea of leaving jail, and then he will be under supervision when he gets out. And my testimony in court and my a detailed report to the judge was the basis of his decision. Now, we have also a new project to tell you about that is just growing. As a part of our empathic therapy organization, as a part of empathictherapy.org, my wife Ginger has now developed, it's up in its early stages, but it's already exciting, a newspaper information center called Toxic Psychiatry. And if you go there, you'll be able to keep up with some of the latest developments in psychiatry, and you'll be able to find our developing, evolving information sources, and in particular a file that we're developing on brain damage from psychiatric drugs. This is just going to grow. It's kind of a Bragan post or an empathic therapy post that looks at the critical side of psychiatry, just as empathic therapy looks at the positive side of what therapists have to offer. Now, when it comes to violence and conflict and communication and the conflict in general between people, the modern psychiatric solution is no solution at all. It's psychiatric drugs. I'm working on a case right now where a woman has been kept in involuntary treatment for months merely because the staff didn't have a clue about how to relate to her, how to encourage her to relate to them, how to deal with conflicts. Instead, they would be provocative, confrontational, drug her against her will, drug her without her knowing, and so on, creating more and more conflict. My guest today, Melanie Sears, who is an RN as well as an MBA, an RN, will be talking with us for the second time on my show. That's how much I value her. For the second time on my show, about nonviolent communication. That is, how to talk peacefully with folks in any setting. And, of course, my particular interest in mental health settings. How to do something other than drug and coerce and bully. How to engage in a positive way. Melanie has written a number of books, including Humanizing Healthcare, Creating Cultures of Compassion with Nonviolent Communication. It's a good book. I read this book. It's a good book. And what Melanie has to say is a gift, not just to the mental health profession, but to the world in general. I understand from Ginger that Melanie's been traveling a bit to exciting places. Maybe she can tell us about that. I want to welcome Melanie Sears to my show. Hi.
Hi, Peter. It's nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's just wonderful to have you back. So would you like to catch us up on some of the wonderful things you're doing in the way of conferences or trainings or books?
Well, I just did a six-and-a-half-week tour of New Zealand and Australia. Trainers and organizers over there set up community workshops for me, and I also trained a software company and worked in two hospitals teaching them the skills of nonviolent communication. And it was really fun to be in New Zealand and Australia and just to get to know the people that live there and understand the culture and bring them some tools that they all indicated were very useful to them.
You know, I have dear friends in New Zealand and Australia. I mean, really dear friends, and I've never been there. Fortunately, they come over here periodically to our conferences and to say hello. Tell me, how did you feel about the reception you got? And do you think things are getting better? Are people looking for better alternatives?
Well, definitely the reception I got in New Zealand and Australia was very warm. And people are looking for different ways of being in the world. And at least the people that came to my workshops, you know, were into healing from the inside out instead of, you know, looking for an answer outside of themselves. Like if they're feeling anxious, looking for some Xanax or something. So these people, you know, were looking to heal from the inside instead of finding a quick fix on the outside. And they're very interested and engaged and excited about what I was sharing. One person was, I was really touched by her comment. She said, "My needs were met for the first time ever," and that she was in her 60s. So one thing I do is first I teach people what their needs are, and then I give them information about what they can do to begin to get their needs met.
Well, I really like the idea of needs. And in one of my books, Beyond Conflict, I talk a lot about basic needs. So tell us your concept of needs and how this woman felt fulfilled for the first time.
Well, needs are, I describe it as universal life energy. So everyone in the world has the same needs, and that's where we connect as human beings on the feelings and the needs level. And needs are, you know, the basic needs, like in Maslow's hierarchy. But the needs work has gone a lot farther than when Maslow did his hierarchy of needs. All humans have needs such as needs for connection, needs for respect. We have needs for empathy that people don't even know they have that need because they've not really gotten any empathy. Since empathy is kind of a rare commodity in this culture. But once you find out what it feels like to receive empathy, then you understand, yes, this is what I've been needing all my life, and you begin to develop strategies of how to get that need met.
You know, I had a marvelous experience of my own just last week with a patient whom I had just met, and who'd been through the psychiatric system. And as he told me his story, and I affirmed what he was saying and the struggles he'd been through and the abuses he'd had, he suddenly got a look on his face that I could not explain. I couldn't understand. It was just some amazing look. And I said, "What are you feeling?" And he said, "For the first time, I feel the anger just lifting up and leaving me." So much for being understood.
That's what empathy does. People need it so badly that when they get it, they begin to transform. They just need to be heard and understood accurately.
So tell more about your idea about needs. Let me make a comment on it. I actually had an encounter with Abraham Maslow when he came to Harvard, and I was an undergraduate. It was 1954 when I entered there, well, 55. And I wasn't really very comfortable with some of what he said. And later on, I realized that he built this concept of needs on the idea that the biology came first. At first, you had to have your food, and you had to have these basic needs taken care of. And then you could, quote, self-actualize, which to some extent was based on, I think, you know, people smoking dope out in the far west somewhere, but that you could actualize yourself, and that came later. And I thought to myself, well, that's not really true. I think that the basic needs for love and empathy are so built into us that people will often live by them rather than break them, even when they're starving to death. So we don't eat each other. We don't necessarily take advantage of each other under the direst straits, because our empathy is a deeper need in many ways than survival. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I think I'm hearing what you're saying, that we have some needs that are very innate, like the needs for love and the needs for connection, the needs for belonging, and just being a human being and having those needs may prevent us from acting out violently.
Even under dire circumstances,
yeah,
that we're really spiritual. We're very spiritual in our values at our core, is what I was getting at.
Yes. Yeah. Marshall Rosenberg, who created the concept of nonviolent communication, he talks about that in his book, about what makes some people not act violently, even in very dire circumstances. And so he did some studies of these people, and he found out, you know, what values they were operating from, and he created nonviolent communication around studying people who were very good at communicating, and from his studies of what creates violence and what creates peace. And what he came up with is the way that we've been socialized to communicate is often very violence provocative. So some of that communication is like we've been taught to judge, to analyze, to criticize, to blame. And of course, when we communicate like that, it creates defensive reactions in other people. And then that person doesn't want to give you what you're wanting in that moment. So it's really kind of a suicidal language, because when you communicate like that, you don't get your needs met. So with
I think that's very, very real, yes.
Yeah. With nonviolent communication, we teach people to communicate in terms of their feelings and needs, which is a universal life energy, which anybody in the world can understand their feelings and needs, because we all share the same feelings and needs. So when you communicate from that, you're much more likely to get your needs met, and you're much more likely to create peaceful connections with people.
This is very, very clear, you know, in couples therapy. I may notice that a man is acting a little threatening on the first visit. You know, I'll see him clench his fist, and I'll see his wife cringe. And I'll right away just bring up and say, you know, I think you've been threatening and maybe hitting your wife. And it'll come tumbling out because I confront it directly. And I'll say to him, listen, I have two pieces of good news for you. First, you're never going to do this again. And second, today you're going to walk out of here with better ways of getting what you need and want from your wife? How'd you like to have her just really, really appreciating you and loving you and wanting to meet some of your needs, maybe all your needs? And of course, the man says, fine. So, well, good. Before we're over today, you're going to find that violence, threats doesn't work at all. And besides, you can't do it. It's wrong. But that if you let yourself express that more vulnerable side of you, and if you let your wife know what it is you need, I think we can start making progress for you getting more out of life and more out of this relationship than you ever dreamed. And I'll just build that on the first day, and it usually works out very, very well.
It sounds like you're really doing some peace-building work by teaching people those tools of how to get their needs met in a more peaceful way.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So you've been to New Zealand, you've been to Australia, and what's your latest book?
Well, the last book that was published was last year, Humanizing Healthcare, Creating Cultures with Compassion with Nonviolent Communication, and it's getting around. It's been translated into German, and it's actually quite popular in German. Germany has a big population of people interested in nonviolent communication because I think they're coming from a real domination culture. And they're looking for alternatives. They're looking for new ways of being, new ways of raising their kids, new ways of being in intimate connection with each other.
I think that's absolutely true. Now, you practice this in personal settings, individual settings, personal and institutional settings. I think I agree with you. I think we probably are in agreement that these basic principles apply everywhere in everything we do. You're with me on that. That we're looking at something very universal.
Yeah, we agree on that.
How did you get to some of these? How did you get to the place you're in right now?
Well, that's a good question.
Take a deep breath and answer as much as you want to.
Well, I've been studying nonviolent communication for 20 years, and it really appealed to me because I had been through a marriage that had failed, and I had been through my childhood was painful in a lot of ways because of the paradigm that it was operating from. My parents were considered good people, and they wanted to do their best, but they didn't have the skills that they needed to really create space for me to grow up in a healthy way. So I was able to really see the contrast. This is the way that my world has been, growing up in this kind of household. My dad was a military officer, and my mother was a Southern Belle. So I grew up in that household, which was not uncommon for people in that generation. And then I ran into nonviolent communication, and I saw what the possibilities could be. And it really spoke to my heart. And since then, I've just been practicing it and applying it in a lot of different ways. Recently, the book is about applying it in the healthcare situation because there is so much pain in that environment, both for not only for patients but also for the staff who work there. And I just think it's sad that people spend so much time working in a job that's painful, where it's not fun to go to work. So I was hoping that by applying these tools to that setting, that people would be more happy going to work and that everybody would benefit.
Are you working mostly with medical or also psychiatric settings?
Well, I work, I'm a per diem nurse in a psychiatric hospital. I float to three units. There's a psychiatric ICU where we get the very chronic violent patients and then a couple other step-down type units.
Talk about working on a violent ward. There must be a certain amount, and you don't have to get into this more than you're comfortable with, there must be a certain amount of horrific inner conflict for you working with psychiatrists. I don't know how much you want to get into that, but talk some about your experience on the violent ward.
Oh, yeah, that makes me laugh to say, to hear you say that. Yeah, I do have a conflict between my ideas of what's good and nurturing for people and then being part of the system that is into medicating people. And I've had to come to a lot of, you know, resolution about that in order to continue doing it. And, you know, I think one resolution I have is it's, I don't see the psychiatrists or the nurses as doing anything wrong. I think they're doing the best they can with what they've got. So, you know, I believe in kind of different, I have different strategies to help people that I think are more effective. But right now in our culture, that is how we treat our
mental
people.
Are you there? I feel
people.
Like I'm losing you.
Oh, can you hear me or not?
Yes, I got you. I got you back.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Do you feel like you can have a good influence on the staff in those settings, or are they resistant?
Well, when I first started working on the psych ICU, that's what I wrote my book about. Instead of just quitting, which kind of is my MO in the past, when I didn't like my job, I would just quit and go get another job. I decided to stick it out, and I'd go to work, and I'd have an experience, and I'd come home, and I'd write a chapter in the book about that experience. And I compare and contrast, you know, the way that things are done in that culture to what the possibilities were. So after I wrote the book, I started passing it around at work. And I think I've had a huge influence on the culture there because it's a totally different culture than when I first wrote the book about it.
Well, that's wonderful. So you're having an effect.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm getting to be, you know, more and more people are getting to know my work and inviting me places to speak and to work with. I like to work a lot with couples lately, and the work I do is very effective with couples because, you know, it really helps to have a common language when you're in a relationship. So,
golly, there's so much to talk about. I'm trying to think of what would be the most useful direction to continue to go in. I mean, you have a private practice. You work on the wards. How do you work in your private practice with these concepts?
Well, people find me one way or another because I don't advertise. So it's usually word of mouth or they've read my book or something and they just come to see me. And I work with them using the live energy of what's going on. And it's kind of funny because usually when couples come, they'll have just had a fight on their way over. And then I'll use that, the energy of that fight to begin to teach them how to give each other empathy, how to really hear each other accurately. And I also teach them tools then of how to communicate in a way that's more likely to get their needs met than the way they have been communicating. So It's very interesting. Just by changing your communication, you begin to change your whole world. You begin to change your whole consciousness because language is just a very powerful. It's very powerful, and you learn language from the time you're born, and so to begin to change the way that you use words, you can begin to change your whole world, and you have more choice in how you react. So you have more. Control over the outcome of your life. You have more creativity in what you want to create instead of just perpetuating habitual patterns.
Do you work with children?
I work with some children, yeah, sometimes. The parents will bring the kids to me. And, of course, kids are very quick at getting what I teach. They're much faster than adults because adults have a lot of unlearning to do before they understand what I'm talking about. But kids get it right away because it's closer to their natural language.
I think that's very, very true. I don't idealize children or childhood. I mean, kids can, at a very early age, become hateful and violent when they're in terrible circumstances. But I do find they learn quicker. I remember a little boy sitting on the couch with his father in my office and mother's over on another chair. And every time The little boy says something Dad doesn't like. Dad is literally squeezing the back of his neck, but doing it in a way he hopes I cannot see. And the boy is resisting, grimacing. And I notice this. I draw attention to it. And I suggest to the family that one of the things I really, really want to teach them is that hands are only for loving and never for inflicting pain, that we should only touch each other out of kindness and care. And they both look at, all three look at me, and the boy says, well, Dad hits me. And we start to have a discussion about this. And I suggest that throughout the remainder of the session, while Dad and son are sitting next to each other, that there be absolutely no physical contact between them other than nice things. And I literally watch for an hour, or maybe there's 40 minutes left, while Dad restrains himself from squeezing and restrains himself and can't quite do it, has to give him a poke here or there. And the little boy is just peacefully in this new presence he has with me, looking at Dad and saying, you know, we're not doing that anymore, Dad. So the kids can respond more quickly. I think of it because they don't have all the hurt and injury necessarily built up. But that's assuming they're coming from families that haven't just driven them into the ground.
Yeah.
So as bad as Dad was treating them, there was still enough love in the family that the old boy could respond without being terrorized, you know, in their presence and work on these things.
Hmm. Yeah. Sounds like that little boy really got what you did and felt a certain amount of safety in your presence.
Yes, I think so. And that's one of the things I try to do in therapy, Mel. I try to create a safe presence where I can actually tell folks exactly what I think and how I wish for them to have their needs taken care of. I wish for them to have empathy for each other and to care for each other. And in my experience, people can have been through many other therapies and therapy experiences, and no one ever said it's about love. It's about empathy. That's what we're here for. There's a set of values that correspond with your basic needs, and we're going to meet them. People, therapists often don't get it, or they feel embarrassed about bringing it up, or they think they shouldn't lay their values on the table. But I'm pretty directive about it. I don't know about your own style.
Well, what I do, I actually teach people empathy skills. So there's actually a technology.
Tell me about that. We got 3 minutes.
Can
you give a 3-minute capsule of teaching empathy skills, and then we'll take a break.
Okay. So teaching empathy skills, I teach people to focus on the feelings and needs being expressed at any time. Because whenever people do anything, they're doing it to meet a need. So even when they're doing something violent, they're trying to meet a need. So instead of judging them for acting violently, I teach people to focus on what need that person is trying to meet, even though they're not meeting it in a very educated way. They're doing the best they can in the moment. So when people focus on the feelings and needs being expressed in each moment, that's empathy. But it takes some practice to be able to focus on feelings and needs instead of analysis or trying to fix people or try to give advice. That's kind of the habitual patterns that people have, or reassure or correct, to really just give them empathy. Like last night, my granddaughter, who's 3 years old, she came up to me and she says, I don't want you here. And I focused on her feelings and needs. I said, wow, sounds like you're feeling kind of angry right now. And you need some understanding for what's going on. And her energy just kind of melted when I said that, you know, because I didn't correct her. I didn't criticize her. I really tried to understand what she was trying to tell me. And I was really glad that I was able to do that.
Did anything more happen, or was that sufficient?
Well, she kind of melted and went back to playing then. But sometimes I think, you know, children come up to you because they're needing some empathy in that moment. And I think that's what she was needing. She just needed a little bit of empathy, and then she went back to her play. But, you know, I think she had been sticking around with some kids that were not being very nice to her. And so she was showing me how she had been treated. And so by giving her a little empathy, it kind of helped her, you know, cope with the whole situation.
One of the things that interests me a lot is, first of all, the relationship between empathy and love, which I think I would like us to talk about when we come back, the relationship between empathy and love. Another thing that interests me is the blocks we have internally to expressing empathy and love. And there I get a little analytic, not psychoanalytic, but analytic about sometimes with myself and my loved ones, not always appreciated, sometimes greatly appreciated, and with my clients about what I think gets in the way of our being empathic and loving toward each other. As we go to break now, I want to remind you that you are listening to Melanie Sears, a registered nurse and a trainer in the Center for Nonviolent Communication since 1992. Thank you, Melanie, for this first half hour, and I look forward to getting back with you soon.
Okay, thank you.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, the conscience of psychiatry. Not necessarily your conscience, but definitely the conscience of psychiatry. I've been working on a new idea for the show. Some of you may have noticed that I don't often take calls. For example, today I got a call about electroshock treatment, and it's just not on topic. So in this case, I suggested the person go to www.bragan.com, and there's an email there, and they can email me and ask me a question. I'll try to respond. I really feel that the continuity of these shows is so good, the guests are so great, that I don't want to get off subject with people asking me questions that don't really relate to the ongoing conversation. So we would welcome questions that are more about the ongoing conversation. But others, I tell my engineer to redirect, my wonderful engineer Giselle, to redirect. However, I'm going to make an experiment. And on December 5th, I'm going to be open to any question at all. I won't have a guest. I'll talk about things that interest me. But you can call me with any question that's appropriate, decent, kindly worded, not combative, and that has a grain, a good solid core maybe of nonviolent communication, like we're talking about on the radio today with my guest Melanie Sears. So keep that in mind, that I'm going to try on December 5th, if nothing else gets in the way, to have a more open show where I talk about different things and callers can call in and chat with me about different things. Now I want to go back to my guest, Melanie. Is there anything, Melanie, you want to pick up on? I have a bunch of ideas myself, but where are you right now?
I just wanted to elaborate a little bit about how I teach empathy to people.
Please.
It's always very interactive, and is that right?
Yeah, go.
In workshops, one thing that we do is we play empathy poker. So we have sets of cards, feelings with feelings on them and needs on them. And I have somebody talk about a personal experience, and the other people will put the feelings and needs down that they hear being expressed. And that begins to focus their energy on empathy instead of on habitual responses like advice. So I did want to mention that there's some technology that I use to actually help people understand how to give empathy.
I wonder if there's an empathy game out there in the world. Maybe you might have market a
game.
Empathy game.
There's a game called Grok.
Oh my gosh, that's from the old sci-fi novels by what's his name now? Oh my gosh, but his theme was, "Do you grok this? Do you grok that?"
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I've forgotten his name.
And there's also there's a couple other games. Sarah Hart has a game out on empathy game, and so there's a lot of fun ways to teach empathy, and people need to learn the skills, really, and it's because they think they know it already, and when what they're doing when they think they're giving empathy, they're giving advice, or they're trying to fix, or they're reassuring, or they're sympathizing. See, none of those are empathy. So with nonviolent communication, you actually learn how to give accurate empathy, and how to focus your attention on the feelings and needs, which is a universal life energy inside of people, which creates a very profound connection.
How much do you emphasize expressing love? I hear a lot of focus on understanding the other person, welcoming their expressions of need. What about expressions of love? Joy, which I define as a joyful awareness or joy in the presence of another person.
Well, I consider empathy as love in action.
Okay.
And do you? Because when I'm receiving empathy, that's what it feels like in my body. It feels like I'm receiving love.
Now, what about the giving of love? Do you talk much about that?
As I give love or empathy,
mm-hmm.
I also am I'm in a place of compassion when I do that. I'm not in judgment. I'm not in analysis. I'm just with that person, and that also feels like love to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's all very, very connected. I like to think of the essence of love as being joyful awareness. And that, of course, is very empathic because you're joyfully aware of somebody. If you just love their existence, you're delighted by their presence, you also are going to be interested in what they're feeling and what they're thinking or what they're struggling with. So my starting point is that joyful awareness of another human being. And I know with my wife and I, with Ginger, we just regularly on a daily basis, maybe many times a day, we just renew that gladness to see each other and be with each other and to have each other.
Hmm. Yeah, I've noticed that you have a very special connection with Ginger.
But I also try to communicate it to some friends and family, but also it's a part of how I want to be with the people I'm working with my clients. And one of the things I see is that we have blocks to this. We have blocks to being joyfully aware and being empathic. I might ask a person to a patient, client really, to do a thought experiment, to just imagine going home and saying to a loved one, you know, I just don't think I tell you enough how much I love you. I'm sure I don't tell you enough how much I love you. And I ask them then to feel what it's like just in this experiment to express that. And very often the person will be experiencing all these blocks to why they haven't done that. They'll feel ashamed, like, oh, the person won't want it. My son won't want that. My husband won't want that. My wife won't want that. I'm not that important. They won't care. These kind of shame experiences. They may feel guilty. Well, I don't deserve to have that kind of ice cream in my life, to just be able to talk about loving and being loved. I don't deserve that. Or they may feel very anxious, unaccountably frightened about doing it. Or it may even bring up anger. They may feel, well, you know, my kid just doesn't behave that well. Or my wife doesn't give me enough love. So one of the things I like to work with is the blocks that people feel internally to empathy and love. Do you do that kind of work or anything close to that or near to that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, that's a big part of the work I do is what is blocking the empathy. One thing is our habitual reactions, you know, how we habitually respond. You know, the other thing, of course, is trauma that we've suffered and fear. Many people are very, very scared of being honest. of expressing their honesty. I mean, almost everyone in this culture is very scared of being honest to somebody, to their face. And this is something I talk about in, as far as the culture change is, you know, what can we do to make people feel, to help people feel more safe in expressing their honesty? Because I think it's, we need it. We need to hear people's honesty. Otherwise, we continue acting in ways that may not be the most effective. Like in my community, I live in a co-housing community, and one of the members is painting the common house, and she painted a wall this green color, and five people mentioned to me that they didn't like it. So I said, well, let's talk to her about it, and none of them would say the truth to her face. So there's a lot of fear of being honest to people face to face, and I work with that fear, and I help empower people to begin to understand their feelings and needs so that they can express them directly. Because if they express it in maybe habitual ways, of course it may create a stimulate a defensive reaction in the other person. So instead of saying, you know, talking to her about their feelings about the green paint, somebody might say, that is really an ugly color you picked. So if they said that to that person, of course it would stimulate a defensive reaction, and there would be bad vibes and conflict from it. But if they express it in terms of their feelings and needs, you know, they might have a better chance of creating a connection and eliciting the help of the person to create a dialogue and to create an outcome that really works better for everybody.
Let me bring up a subject where we may or may not agree on, but which is very interesting to me, and I think maybe on the minds of some folks who listen to this. There are situations, in my experience, where empathy and empathic relationship is not possible, and that one must draw a line and protect oneself and let someone know that there are consequences. I work in a very politicized arena of psychiatric reform. By the way, this should rarely come up in a personal relationship, maybe once in a while, but very rarely come up in any kind of therapeutic relationship where you're a professional person. But when I'm out in the political arena, I find that in reality, people often have very different conflicting interests. They may want to take something from you that you have, or ride on your coattails, or get you out of the political picture. That there's a lot of conflict which really cannot be resolved because the other person has interests that don't include you. And so I find that in addition to being a soft, caring person in my personal life, I try to be, I think that's how practically everybody who knows me personally thinks of me. I also have a side to me, especially in the more public arena, that says, you know, if you're going to mess with me, there are consequences. I'm tough. What do you think about that?
I actually like it.
Oh, good. I didn't know if you'd like it.
Yeah, well, I believe that it all starts with ourselves. You know, it's not about giving empathy to everyone and healing the world. It's about starting with yourself and coming from a place of center. Now, sometimes I am not in a space to give empathy, so I don't give empathy. I don't give empathy for somebody else's sake. I give it for myself. One benefit that I get from giving empathy is I don't take things personally, because I really see that what the person is saying is about them. But so taking care of yourself is very important, and I celebrate that you do that as well as you do it. And in nonviolent communication, we talk about protective use of force versus punitive use of force. So often there are times when, you know, we need to use protective use of force in order to protect ourselves.
I think that's very, very real, and I want those who are listening to us today to know that apparently Melanie, as well as I, we start from a position that does say, you know, we have to take care of ourselves. We're, in a sense, we're all inviolable. I will not gratuitously harm you, and I expect you not to gratuitously harm me. I'm willing to talk with you about almost anything, but I'm not willing to let you bully me, push me around. And this becomes an issue for children on the playground. We want our kids to be loving and to learn nonviolent communication, to be caring for each other. But in this world, and I believe in any world where human nature is thriving, for better or worse, our kids also need to be able to have an expression on their face or a way of looking that says, you've gone too far, I draw the line. If you go further in bullying me, you go at your own risk. I really feel that very strongly, and I hate to see that taken away from our children, because I think that we can't really manage to the maximum in the world unless we're prepared to draw those lines. So that consistent with what you think as well?
Yeah, well, pretty much. Yeah, I believe that we need to be honest and true to ourselves and to take care of ourselves. Like the other day at work, this patient held out her hand to shake my hand, and I shook her hand, and she started grinding my bones together. And I said, ow, that hurts. And I pulled my hand back, and I said, that's not okay with me. You know, I don't know why you decided to do that, but that's not okay. So it's not about being nice. It's about being real. And about, I think it's very important to the people to set those limits, like with children. I think it's important for them to know how they affect the world around them. And if we're not honest about it, then they're not going to learn that.
I think that's really good, too. Let me raise another complexity. I mean, it's a pleasure to talk with you and be able to raise the complexities of all these issues. One of the things I believe is that emotions are not reality. They're signals inside ourselves about what's going on. So that if we're very, very angry at somebody, it's not a reality that we have to express necessarily. It's not a reality that they've even hurt us. It's a feeling, a signal for us to examine. And I encourage people to process anger carefully before expressing it. I don't encourage necessarily spontaneous anger unless a person really has such a problem expressing anger they need to work on it. For example, a patient might come, or a client might come to me in the first session or two and just be ranting about the folks, including me. They may start ranting about what I charge or about my waiting room or something. This is not common, but at least in minor variations and sometimes stronger ones, it'll happen. And I'll say, slow down now. If you keep attacking me, you put me on a defensive, I can't give you the best of me. So you really need to work on not putting me on the defensive, because it just isn't going to allow you to benefit from all I have to offer. Now, the person at that point, if they're really compulsive about their anger, might say, well, I mean, isn't therapy the place where you get to express anything you feel? And I will say, no, you've been doing that, I'm sure, forever outside of this therapy. Therapy is where you get to learn to build a safe, trusting, and even caring relationship. I want to help you learn to develop the capacity to communicate in a caring, loving way that people can respond to and build good relations around. And I've seen on occasion that one communication change a person's life, where they realize, No, they can't just go on with the ranting, with the anger, with the hurting, with the putting people on defensive, that it's not in their interest because they can't get the best out of the other person.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. If we express our anger, we're very likely to create a defensive reaction in others, and then we won't get our needs met. It's one of those suicidal ways of communicating.
I like that phrase, suicidal communication. So I usually just call it self-destructive, but I think it's quite graphic to it's kamikaze communication.
I agree with you that our feelings give us some information about what's going on inside of us. They're not reality. They're taking us to our inner reality at that moment. Our feelings are giving us clues whether our needs are being met or not met. If our needs are being met, we'll probably have positive feelings. If our needs are not being met, we'll express negative feelings. So when I work with people who are angry, I helped them understand what needs are underneath their anger, because anger tells us that our needs are not being met, and people sometimes don't know other ways of expressing that frustration and that anger. But if they can get the clue to finding what need is not being met in that moment, then they're much more likely to be able to express that need in a less violent way. Anger can create a lot of violence. So I also recommend that people don't express their anger until they're in touch with their need, because people won't be able to hear it.
I'm really with you 100% on that. One of the things I like to suggest to people is that anger is actually the most superficial emotion. Even though it feels at the moment like it's the most real, it's the deepest, this is what I really mean, actually beneath it is your vulnerability, your hurt. You're hurt, and that's why you're angry. So let's get to the hurt, and if you're in a safe relationship, start with the hurt rather than the anger. Get a little deeper than the anger, because people really think both men and women at times that anger is what empowers them, when almost invariably they're feeling very disempowered at the time they're being angry, and getting angry is really displaying how out of control they feel, not how powerful they feel. So anger is very complicated thing to look at. At other times, it's very important to let people know we're angry, because it's just like, you know, letting them know they're stepping on our tail, and that's our immediate reaction is, hey, what are you doing? What are you doing to me?
Yeah. Well, anger is an emotion that's actually caused by our thinking. If we're either thinking that somebody should or shouldn't be doing something, or we're thinking or we're judging them, it's not the other person that's causing our anger, but it's our thinking that's causing our anger. And underneath the anger are other emotions, fear, shame, hurt, something like that, that we're kind of not in touch with at that moment. So when I teach people, you know, one, where their anger comes from, and teach them to get in touch with their needs, then they find the other more vulnerable feelings underneath it. And at that time, they can begin to express, and they're more likely to get their needs met if they express from that place, that place of vulnerability, than from the place of anger.
Melanie, we have, I'd say, 2 minutes left before we finish up. Would you like to take a minute and just kind of say whatever you'd like to say to our audience?
Well, I think learning the tools of nonviolent communication, the tools that you share with your clients, is a journey. It's not a destination, and it takes a while. And there are many resources out there that people can discover that can help them along that journey. The Center for Nonviolent Communication has a list of trainers worldwide that work with these skills, that work with people.
You want to give that website?
It's the website is www.cnvc, that stands for Center for Nonviolent Communication, .org, or my website they could reach me at and also get a copy of my books is www.dnadialogues.com.
dnadialogues.com.
Yeah.
Melanie, thank you very much for being on the show. And I want to just reemphasize that the things we're talking about today really get to the heart of human relationship. I have a very spiritual attitude toward all of this. I really think we're more than our brains, that we're beings or spirits or souls or however you conceive of us as being somehow sacred and inviolable beings,
yeah.
And that we need to bring to each other a caring and a treasuring that gets to each other's hearts. And with that thought, the Conscience of Psychiatry,
definitely.
Thanks Melanie Sears for being on the show, and we will see you again next week.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bregan and his lifelong reform work on www.bregan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.